Rose watched her. She knew she did not know who Irian was, or what she might be. A big, strong, awkward, ignorant, innocent, angry woman, yes. But ever since she was a child, Rose had seen something more in her, something beyond what she was. And when Irian looked away from the world like that, she seemed to enter that place, or time, or being beyond herself, utterly beyond Rose's knowledge. Then Rose feared her, and feared for her.
"You take care," the witch said, grim. "Everything's perilous, right enough, and meddling with wizards most of all."
Through love, respect, and trust, Dragonfly would never disregard a warning from Rose, but she was unable to see Ivory as perilous. She didn't understand him, but the idea of fearing him, him personally, was not one she could keep in mind. She tried to be respectful, but it was impossible. She thought he was clever and quite handsome, but she didn't think much about him, except for what he could tell her. He knew what she wanted to know, and little by little he told it to her. And then, it was not really what she had wanted to know, but she wanted to know more. He was patient with her, and she was grateful to him for his patience, knowing he was much quicker than she. Sometimes he smiled at her ignorance, but he never sneered at it or reproved it. Like the witch, he liked to answer a question with a question. But the answers to Rose's questions were always something she'd always known, while the answers to his questions were things she had never imagined, and found startling, unwelcome, even painful, altering all her beliefs. Day by day, as they talked in the old stable yard of Iria, where they had fallen into the habit of meeting, she asked him, and he told her more, though reluctantly, always partially. He shielded his master, she thought, trying to defend the bright image of Roke, until one day he gave in to her insistence and spoke freely at last. "There are good men there," he said. "Great and wise the Archmage certainly was, but he's gone, and the masters. Some hold aloof, following arcane knowledge, seeking ever more patterns, ever more names, but using their knowledge for nothing. Others hide their ambition under the gray cloak of wisdom. Roke is no longer where power is in Earthsea. That's the court in Havner now. Roke lives on its great past, defended by a thousand spells against the present day. And inside those spell walls, what is there? Quarreling ambitions, fear of anything new, fear of young men who challenge the power of the old, and at the center, nothing. An empty courtyard. The Archmage will never return."
"How do you know?" she whispered.
He looked stern. The dragon bore him away.
"You saw it? You saw that?"
She clenched her hands, imagining that flight. After a while she came back to the sunlight and the stable yard, and her thoughts and puzzles. "But even if he's gone," she said, "surely some of the masters are truly wise." When he looked up and spoke, it was with a hint of a melancholy smile.
"All the mystery and wisdom of the masters, when it's out in the daylight, doesn't amount to so much, you know. Tricks of the trade. Wonderful illusions. But people don't want to believe that. They want the mysteries, the illusions. Who can blame them? There's so little in most lives that's beautiful or worthy."
As if to illustrate what he was saying, he had picked up a bit of brick from the broken pavement and tossed it up in the air, and as he spoke, it fluttered above their heads on delicate blue wings, a butterfly. He put out his finger, and the butterfly lighted on it. He shook his finger, and the butterfly fell to the ground, a fragment of brick.
"There's not much worth much in my life," she said,
gazing down at the pavement. "All I know how to do is run the farm, and try to stand up and speak truth. But if I thought it was all tricks and lies, even on Roke, I'd hate those men for fooling me
fooling us all. It can't be lies, not all of it. The Archmage did go into the labyrinth among the hoary men and come back with the Ring of Peace. He did go into death with the young king and defeat the Spider Mage and come back. We know that, on the word of the king himself. Even here, the harpers came to sing that song, and a teller came to tell it. Ivory nodded gravely.
But the Archmage lost all his power in the land of death. Maybe all magery was weakened then.
Rose's spells work as well as ever, she said stoutly. Ivory smiled.
He said nothing, but she knew how petty the doings of a village witch appeared to him, who had seen great deeds and powers.
She sighed and spoke from her heart.
Oh, if only I wasn't a woman.
He smiled again. You're a beautiful woman, he said, but plainly, not in the flattering way he had used with her at first, before she showed him she hated it. Why would you be a man?
So I could go to Roke, and see and learn. Why? Why is it only men can go there?
So it was ordained by the first Archmage, centuries ago, said Ivory. But I, too, have wondered.
You have?
Often. Seeing only boys and men, day after day, in the great house and all the precincts of the school, knowing that the townswomen are spellbound from so much as setting foot on the fields about Roke Knoll. Once in years, perhaps, some great lady is allowed to come briefly into the outer courts. Why is it so? Are all women incapable of understanding? Or is it that the masters fear them? Fear to be corrupted? No. But fear that to admit women might change the rule they cling to. The purity of that rule.
Women can live chaste as well as men can, Dragonfly said bluntly. She knew she was blunt and coarse, where he was delicate and subtle, but she did not know any other way to be.
Of course, he said, his smile growing brilliant.
But witches aren't always chaste, are they? Maybe that's what the masters are afraid of. Maybe celibacy isn't as necessary as the rule of Roke teaches. Maybe it's not a way of keeping the power pure, but of keeping the power to themselves. Leaving out women, leaving out everybody who won't agree to turn himself into a eunuch to get that one kind of power.
Who knows?
A she-mage. Now that would change everything. All the rules.
She could see his mind dance ahead of hers, taking up and playing with ideas, transforming them as he had transformed brick into butterfly. She could not dance with him. She could not play with him. But she watched him in wonder.
You could go to Roke, he said, his eyes bright with excitement, mischief, daring.
Meeting her almost pleading, incredulous silence, he insisted,
You could. A woman you are, but there are ways to change your seeming. You have the heart, the courage, the will of a man.
You could enter the great house.
I know it.
And what would I do there?
What all students do. Live alone in a stone cell and learn to be wise. It might not be what you dream it to be, but that, too, you'd learn.
I couldn't. They'd know. I couldn't even get in. There's the doorkeeper, you said. I don't know the word to say to him.
The password, yes. But I can teach it to you.
You can? Is it allowed?
I don't care what's allowed, he said, with a frown she had never seen on his face. The Archmage himself said, Rules are made to be broken. Injustice makes the rules, and courage breaks them. I have the courage, if you do.
She looked at him. She could not speak. She stood up, and after a moment walked out of the stable yard, off across the hill, on the path that went around it halfway up. One of the dogs, her favorite,
A big, ugly, heavy-headed hound followed her. She stopped on the slope above the marshy spring where Rose had named her 10 years ago. She stood there. The dog sat down beside her and looked up at her face. No thought was clear in her mind, but words repeated themselves. I could go to Roke and find out who I am. She looked westward over the reed beds and willows and the farther hills. The whole western sky was empty, clear. She stood still, and her soul seemed to go into that sky and be gone, gone out of her. There was a little noise, the soft clip-clop of the black mare's hoofs coming along the lane. Then Dragonfly came back to herself and called to Ivory and ran down the hill to meet him. I will go, she said. He had not planned or intended any such adventure, but crazy as it was, it suited him better the more he thought about it. The prospect of spending the long gray winter in Westpool sank his spirits like a stone. There was nothing here for him except the girl Dragonfly, who had come to fill his thoughts. Her massive innocent strength had defeated him absolutely so far, but he did what she pleased, in order to have her do at last what he pleased, and the game, he thought, was worth playing. If she ran away with him, the game was as good as won. As for the joke of it, the notion of actually getting her into the school of Roke disguised as a man, there was little chance of pulling it off, but it pleased him, as a gesture of disrespect to all the piety and pomposity of the masters and their toadies. And if, somehow, it succeeded, if he could actually get a woman through that door, even for a moment, what a sweet revenge it would be. Money was a problem. The girl thought, of course, that he, as a great wizard, would snap his fingers and waft them over the sea in a magic boat flying before the mage wind. But when he told her they'd have to hire passage on a ship, she said simply, I have the cheese money. He treasured her rustic sayings of that kind. Sometimes she frightened him, and he resented it. His dreams of her were never of her yielding to him, but of himself yielding to a fierce, destroying sweetness, sinking into an annihilating embrace. Dreams in which she was something beyond comprehension, and he was nothing at all. He woke from those dreams shaken and shamed. In daylight, when he saw her big, dirty hands, when she talked like a yokel, a simpleton, he regained his superiority. He only wished there were someone to repeat her sayings to, one of his old friends in the great port who would find them amusing. I have the cheese money, he repeated to himself, riding back to Westpool, and laughed. I do indeed, he said aloud. The black mare flicked her ear. He told Birch that he had received a sending from his teacher on Roke, the master hand, and must go at once, on what business he could not say, of course, but it should not take long once he was there. A half a month to go, another to return. He would be back well before the fallows at the latest. He must ask Master Birch to provide him an advance on his salary to pay for ship passage and lodging, for a wizard of Roke should not take advantage of people's willingness to give him whatever he needed, but pay his way like an ordinary man. As Birch agreed with this, he had to give Ivory a purse for his journey. It was the first real money he had had in his pocket for years. 10 ivory counters, carved with the otter of Shelyeth on one side and the ruin of peace on the other, in honor of the King Lebanon. Hello, little namesakes, he told them when he was alone with them. You and the cheese money will get along nicely. He told Dragonfly very little of his plans, largely because he made few, trusting to chance and his own wits, which seldom let him down if he was given a fair chance to use them. The girl asked almost no questions. Will I go as a man all the way? Was one. Yes, he said, but only disguised, I won't put a semblance spell on you till we're on Roke Island.
I thought it would be a spell of change, she said.
That would be unwise, he said, with a good imitation of the Master Changer's terse solemnity. If need be, I'll do it, of course. But you'll find wizards very sparing of the great spells, for good reason.
The equilibrium, she said, accepting all he said in its simplest sense, as always.
And perhaps because such arts have not the power they once had, he said.
He did not know himself why he tried to weaken her faith in wizardry. Perhaps because any weakening of her strength, her wholeness, was a gain for him. He had begun merely by trying to get her into his bed, a game he loved to play. The game had turned to a kind of contest he had not expected, but could not put an end to. He was determined now not to win her, but to defeat her. He could not let her defeat him. He must prove to her and himself that his dreams were meaningless. Quite early on, impatient with wooing her massive physical indifference, he had worked up a charm, a sorcerer's seduction spell, of which he was contemptuous even as he made it, though he knew it was effective. He cast it on her while she was characteristically mending a cow's halter. The result had not been the melting eagerness it had produced in girls he had used it on in Havner and Thwill. Dragonfly had gradually become silent and sullen. She ceased asking her endless questions about Roke, and did not answer when he spoke. When he very tentatively approached her, taking her hand, she struck him away with a blow to the head that left him dizzy. He saw her stand up and stride out of the stable-yard without a word, the ugly hound she favored trotting after her. It looked back at him with a grin. She took the path to the old house. When his ear stopped ringing, he stole after her, hoping the charm was working, and that this was only her particularly uncouth way of leading him at last to her bed. Nearing the house, he heard crockery breaking. The father, the drunkard, came wobbling out, looking scared and confused, followed by Dragonfly's loud, harsh voice. "Out of the house, you drunken, crawling traitor! You foul, shameless lecher!
She took my cup away," the master of Iria said to the stranger, whining like a puppy, while his dogs yammered around him. "She broke it."
Ivory departed. He did not return for 2 days. On the third day, he rode experimentally past old Iria, and she came striding down to meet him. "I'm sorry, Ivory," she said, looking up at him with her smoky orange eyes. "I don't know what came over me the other day. I was angry, but not at you. I beg your pardon."
He forgave her gracefully. He did not try a love charm on her again. Soon, he thought now, he would not need one. He would have real power over her. He had finally seen how to get it. She had given it into his hands. Her strength and her willpower were tremendous, but fortunately she was stupid, and he was not. Birch was sending a carter down to Kembermouth with 6 barrels of 10-year-old Fainian, ordered by the wine merchant there. He was glad to send his wizard along as bodyguard, for the wine was valuable, and though the young king was putting things to rights as fast as he could, there were still gangs of robbers on the roads. So Ivory left Westpool on the big wagon pulled by 4 big cart horses, jolting slowly along, his legs dangling. Down by Jackass Hill, an uncouth figure rose up from the wayside and asked the carter for a lift.
"I don't know you," the carter said, lifting his whip to warn the stranger off.
But Ivory came round the wagon and said, "Oh, let the lad ride, my good man. He'll do no harm while I'm with you."
"Keep an eye on him then, master," said the carter.
"I will," said Ivory, with a wink at Dragonfly.
She, well disguised in dirt and a farmhand's old smock and leggings and a loathsome felt hat, did not wink back. She played her part even while they sat side by side, dangling their legs over the tailgate, with 6 great half-tons of wine jolting between them and the drowsy carter, and the drowsy summer hills and fields, slipping slowly, slowly past. Ivory tried to tease her, but she only shook her head. Maybe she was scared by this wild scheme, now she was embarked on it. There was no telling. She was solemnly, heavily, silent. I could be very bored by this woman, Ivory thought, if once I'd had her underneath me. That thought stirred him almost unbearably. But when he looked back at her, his thoughts died away before her massive, actual presence. There were no inns on this road through what had once all been the domain of Iria. As the sun neared the western plains, they stopped at a farmhouse that offered stabling for horses, a shed for the cart, and straw in the stable loft for the carters. The loft was dark and stuffy, and the straw musty. Ivory felt no lust at all, though Dragonfly lay not 3 feet from him. She had played the man so thoroughly all day that she had half convinced even him. Well, maybe she'll fool the old man after all, he thought, and grinned at the thought, and slept. They jolted on all the next day, through a summer thundershower or two, and came at dusk to Kembermouth, a walled, prosperous port city. They left the carter to his master's business, and walked down to find an inn near the docks. Dragonfly looked about at the sights of the city in a silence that might have been awe, or disapproval, or mere stolidity. "This is a nice little town," Ivory said, "but the only city in the world is Havner." It was no use trying to impress her. All she said was, "Ships don't trade much to Roke, do they? Will it take a long time to find one to take us, do you think?" "Not if I carry a staff," he said. She stopped looking about and strode along in thought for a while. She was beautiful in movement, bold and graceful, her head carried high. "You mean they'll oblige a wizard? But you aren't a wizard." "Oh, well, that's a formality. We senior sorcerers may carry a staff when we're on Roke's business, which I am." "Taking me there?" "Bringing them a student, yes. A student of great gifts." She asked no more questions. She never argued. It was one of her virtues. That night, over supper at the Waterfront Inn, she asked with unusual timidity in her voice, "Do I have great gifts?" "In my judgment, you do," he said. She pondered. Conversation with her was often a slow business, and said, "Rose always said I had power, but she didn't know what kind. And I know I do, but I don't know what it is." "You're going to Roke to find out," he said, raising his glass to her. And after a moment, she raised hers and smiled at him. A smile so tender and radiant that he said spontaneously, "And may what you find be all you seek." "If I do, it will be thanks to you," she said. In that moment, he loved her for her true heart, and would have forsworn any thought of her but as his companion in a bold adventure, a gallant joke. They had to share a room at the crowded inn with 2 other travelers, but Ivory's thoughts were perfectly chaste, though he laughed at himself a little for it. The next morning, he picked a sprig of an herb from the kitchen garden of the inn and spelled it into the semblance of a fine staff, copper-shod, and his own height exactly. "What is the wood?" Dragonfly asked, fascinated when she saw it, and when he answered with a laugh, "Rosemary," she laughed too.
They set off along the wharves, asking for a ship bound south that might take a wizard and his prentice to the Isle of the Wise, and soon enough they found a heavy trader bound for Wathort, whose master would carry the wizard for goodwill and the prentice for half price. Even half price was half the cheese money, but they would have the luxury of a cabin, for Sea Otter was a decked, two-masted ship. As they were talking with her master, a wagon drew up on the dock and began to unload 6 familiar half-ton barrels. "That's ours," Ivory said, and the ship's master said, "Bound for Hort Town." And Dragonfly said softly, "From Iria." She glanced back at the land then. It was the only time he ever saw her look back. The ship's weather worker came aboard just before they sailed. No roque wizard, but a weather-beaten fellow in a worn sea cloak. Ivory flourished his staff a little in greeting him. The sorcerer looked him up and down and said, "One man works weather on this ship. If it's not me, I'm off." "Oh, I'm a mere passenger, Master Bagman. I gladly leave the winds in your hands." The sorcerer looked at Dragonfly, who stood straight as a tree, and said nothing. "Good," he said, and that was the last word he spoke to Ivory. During the voyage, however, he talked several times with Dragonfly, which made Ivory a bit uneasy. Her ignorance and trustfulness could endanger her, and therefore him. "What did she and the bagman talk about?" he asked, and she answered, "What is to become of us?" He stared. "Oh, of all of us, of Way and Felkway and Havnor and Wathort and Roque, all the people of the islands. He says that when King Labannon was to be crowned last autumn, he sent to Gaunt for the old archmage to come crown him, and he wouldn't come. And there was no new archmage, so he took the crown himself. And some say that's wrong, and he doesn't rightly hold the throne, but others say the king himself is the new archmage. But he isn't a wizard, only a king. So others say the dark years will come again, when there was no rule of justice, and wizardry was used for evil ends." After a pause, Ivory said, "That old weather worker says all this." "It's common talk, I think," said Dragonfly, with her grave simplicity. The weather worker knew his trade, at least. Sea Otter sped south. They met summer squalls and choppy seas, but never a storm or a troublesome wind. They put off and took on cargo at ports on the north shore of O, at Ilion, Lang, Camery, and Oport, and then headed west to carry the passengers to Roque. And facing the west, Ivory felt a little hollow at the pit of his stomach, for he knew all too well how Roque was guarded. He knew neither he nor the weather worker could do anything at all to turn the Roque wind if it blew against them, and if it did, Dragonfly would ask why did it blow against them? He was glad to see the sorcerer uneasy too, standing by the helmsman, keeping a watch up on the masthead, taking in sail at the hint of a west wind. But the wind held steady from the north. A thunder squall came pelting on that wind, and Ivory went down to the cabin, but Dragonfly stayed up on deck. She was afraid of the water, she had told him. She could not swim, she said. Drowning must be a horrible thing, not to breathe the air. She had shuddered at the thought. It was the only fear she had ever shown of anything. But she disliked the low, cramped cabin, and had stayed on deck every day and slept there on the warm nights. Ivory had not tried to coax her into the cabin. He knew now that coaxing was no good. To have her, he must master her, and that he would do, if only they could come to Roque. He came up on deck again. It was clearing, and as the sun set, the clouds broke all across the west, showing a golden sky behind the high, dark curve of a hill. Ivory looked at that hill, with a kind of longing hatred.
"That's Roke Knoll, lad," the weather worker said to Dragonfly, who stood beside him at the rail. "We're coming into Thwill Bay now. Where there's no wind but the wind they want."
By the time they were well into the bay and had let down the anchor, it was dark, and Ivory said to the ship's master, "I'll go ashore in the morning." Down in their tiny cabin, Dragonfly sat waiting for him, solemn as ever, but her eyes blazing with excitement. "We'll go ashore in the morning," he repeated to her, and she nodded, acceptant. She said, "Do I look all right?" He sat down on his narrow bunk and looked at her sitting on her narrow bunk. They could not face each other directly, as there was no room for their knees. At Oport, she had bought herself a decent shirt and breeches, at his suggestion, so as to look a more probable candidate for the school. Her face was wind-burned and scrubbed clean. Her hair was braided, and the braid clubbed, like Ivory's. She had got her hands clean, too, and they lay flat on her thighs, long, strong hands, like a man's.
"You don't look like a man," he said.
Her face fell.
"Not to me. You'll never look like a man to me. But don't worry, you will to them."
She nodded, with an anxious face.
"The first test is the great test, Dragonfly," he said. Every night he lay alone in this cabin, he had planned this conversation. To enter the great house, to go through that door. "I've been thinking about it," she said, hurried and earnest. "Couldn't I just tell them who I am, with you there to vouch for me, to say even if I am a woman, I have some gift, and I'd promise to take the vow and make the spell of celibacy, and live apart if they wanted me to."
He was shaking his head all through her speech.
"No, no, no, no. Hopeless, useless, fatal. Even if I argued for you, they won't listen. The rule of Roke forbids women to be taught any high art, any word of the language of the making. It's always been so. They will not listen, so they must be shown. And we'll show them, you and I. We'll teach them. You must have courage, Dragonfly. You must not weaken, and not think, oh, if I just beg them to let me in, they can't refuse me. They can, and will. And, if you reveal yourself, they will punish you, and me."
He put a ponderous emphasis on the last word, and inwardly murmured, "Avert." She gazed at him from her unreadable eyes and finally said, "What must I do?"
"Do you trust me, Dragonfly?"
"Yes."
"Will you trust me entirely, wholly, knowing that the risk I take for you is greater even than your risk in this venture?"
"Yes."
"Then you must tell me the word you will speak to the doorkeeper."
She stared. But I thought you'd tell it to me, the password."
"The password he will ask you for is your true name."
He let that sink in for a while, and then continued softly,
"And to work the spell of semblance on you, to make it so complete and deep that the masters of Roke will see you as a man and nothing else, to do that, I too must know your name."
He paused again. As he talked, it seemed to him that everything he said was true, and his voice was moved and gentle as he said, "I could have known it long ago, but I chose not to use those arts. I wanted you to trust me enough to tell me your name yourself." She was looking down at her hands, clasped now on her knees. In the faint reddish glow of the cabin lantern, her lashes cast very delicate long shadows on her cheeks. She looked up, straight at him. "My name is Irion," she said. He smiled. She did not smile. He said nothing. In fact, he was at a loss. If he had known it would be this easy, He could have had her name, and with it, the power to make her do whatever he wanted days ago, weeks ago, with a mere pretense at this crazy scheme, without giving up his salary and his precarious respectability, without this sea voyage, without having to go all the way to Roke for it. For he saw the whole plan now was folly. There was no way he could disguise her that would fool the doorkeeper for a moment. All his notions of humiliating the masters, as they had humiliated him, were moonshine. Obsessed with tricking the girl, he had fallen into the trap he had laid for her. Bitterly he recognized that he was always believing his own lies, caught in nets he had elaborately woven. Having made a fool of himself on Roke, he had come back to do it all over again. A great, desolate anger swelled up in him. There was no good. No good in anything. "What's wrong?" she asked. The gentleness of her deep, husky voice unmanned him, and he hid his face in his hands, fighting against the shame of tears. She put her hand on his knee. It was the first time she had ever touched him. He endured it, the warmth and weight of her touch that he had wasted so much time wanting. He wanted to hurt her, to shock her out of her terrible, ignorant kindness. But what he said when he finally spoke was, "I only wanted to make love to you." "You did." "Did you think I was one of their eunuchs? That I'd castrate myself with spells so I could be holy? Why do you think I don't have a staff? Why do you think I'm not at the school? Did you believe everything I said?" "Yes," she said. "I'm sorry." Her hand was still on his knee. She said, "We can make love if you want." He sat up. Sat still. "What are you?" he said to her at last. "I don't know. It's why I wanted to come to Roke. To find out." He broke free, stood up, stooping. Neither of them could stand straight in the low cabin. Clenching and unclenching his hands, he stood as far from her as he could, his back to her. "You won't find out. It's all lies, shams, old men playing games with words. I wouldn't play their games, so I left. Do you know what I did?" He turned, showing his teeth in a rictus of triumph. "I got a girl, a town girl, to come to my room, my cell, my little stone celibate cell. It had a window looking out on a back street. No spells. You can't make spells with all their magic going on. But she wanted to come, and came, and I let a rope ladder out the window, and she climbed it. And we were at it when the old men came in. I showed 'em. And if I could have got you in, I'd have showed 'em again. I'd have taught them their lesson." "Well, I'll try," she said. He stared. "Not for the same reasons as you," she said. "But I still want to. And we came all this way. And you know my name." It was true. He knew her name. Irian. It was like a coal of fire, a burning ember in his mind. His thought could not hold it. His knowledge could not use it. His tongue could not say it. She looked up at him, her sharp, strong face softened by the shadowy lantern light. "If it was only to make love you brought me here, Ivory," she said, "we can do that, if you still want to." Wordless at first, he simply shook his head. After a while, he was able to laugh. "I think we've gone on past that possibility." She looked at him without regret, or reproach, or shame. "Irian," he said. And now her name came easily, sweet and cool as spring water in his dry mouth. "Irian, here's what you must do to enter the great house." He left her at the corner of the street, a narrow, dull, somehow sly-looking street that slanted up between featureless walls to a wooden door in a higher wall. He had put his spell on her, and she looked like a man, though she did not feel like one. She and Ivory took each other in their arms, because after all they had been friends, companions, and he had done all this for her. "Courage," he said, and let her go. She walked up the street and stood before the door. She looked back then, but he was gone. She knocked. After a while she heard the latch rattle. The door opened. An ordinary-looking middle-aged man stood there. "What can I do for you?" he said. He did not smile, but his voice was pleasant. "You can let me into the great house, sir."
"Do you know the way in?"
His almond-shaped eyes were attentive, yet seemed to look at her from miles or years away.
"This is the way in, sir." "Do you know whose name you must tell me before I let you in?"
"My own, sir. It is Irian."
"Is it?" he said.
That gave her pause. She stood silent. "It's the name the witch Rose of my village on Way gave me, in the spring, under Iria Hill," she said at last, standing up and speaking truth. The doorkeeper looked at her for what seemed a long time.
"Then it is your name," he said. "But maybe not all your name. I think you have another."
"I don't know it, sir." After another long time, she said, "Maybe I can learn it here, sir." The doorkeeper bowed his head a little. A very faint smile made crescent curves in his cheeks. He stood aside.
"Come in, daughter," he said.
She stepped across the threshold of the great house. Ivory's spell of semblance dropped away like a cobweb. She was, and looked, herself. She followed the doorkeeper down a stone passageway. Only at the end of it did she think to turn back to see the light shine through the thousand leaves of the tree carved in the high door in its bone-white frame. A young man in a gray cloak hurrying down the passageway stopped short as he approached them. He stared at Irian. Then, with a brief nod, he went on. She looked back at him. He was looking back at her. A globe of misty greenish fire drifted swiftly down the corridor at eye level, apparently pursuing the young man. The doorkeeper waved his hand at it, and it avoided him. Irian swerved and ducked down frantically, but felt the cool fire tingle in her hair as it passed over her. The doorkeeper looked round, and now his smile was wider. Though he said nothing, she felt he was aware of her, concerned for her. She stood up and followed him. He stopped before an oak door. Instead of knocking, he sketched a little sign or rune on it with the top of his staff, a light staff of some grayish wood. The door opened as a resonant voice behind it said, "Come in." "Wait here a little, if you please, Irian," the doorkeeper said, and went into the room, leaving the door wide open behind him. She could see bookshelves and books, a table piled with more books and inkpots and writings, two or three boys seated at the table, and the gray-haired, stocky man the doorkeeper spoke to. She saw the man's face change, saw his eyes shift to her in a brief, startled gaze, saw him question the doorkeeper, low-voiced, intense. They both came to her.
The master changer of Roke, Irian of Way, said the doorkeeper. The changer stared openly at her. He was not as tall as she was. He stared at the doorkeeper, and then at her again.
Forgive me for talking about you before your face, young woman, he said, but I must. Master doorkeeper, you know I'd never question your judgment, but the rule is clear. I have to ask what moved you to break it and let her come in.
She asked too, said the doorkeeper.
But, the changer paused. When did a woman last ask to enter the school?
They know the rule doesn't allow them.
Did you know that, Irian? The doorkeeper asked her, and she said,
Yes, sir.
So, what brought you here? The changer asked, stern, but not hiding his curiosity.
Master Ivory said I could pass for a man, though I thought I should say who I was. I will be as celibate as anyone, sir.
Two long curves appeared on the doorkeeper's cheeks, enclosing the slow upturn of his smile. The changer's face remained stern, but he blinked, and after a little thought said,
I'm sure, yes, it was definitely the better plan, to be honest. What master did you speak of?
Ivory, said the doorkeeper. A lad from Havner Greatport, whom I let in 3 years ago, and let out again last year, as you may recall.
Ivory? That fellow that studied with the hand? Is he here?
The changer demanded of Irian, wrathily. She stood straight and said nothing.
Not in the school, the doorkeeper said, smiling. He fooled you, young woman. Made a fool of you by trying to make fools of us.
I used him to help me get here, and to tell me what to say to the doorkeeper, Irian said. I'm not here to fool anybody, but to learn what I need to know.
I've often wondered why I let the boy in, said the doorkeeper. Now I begin to understand.
At that, the changer looked at him, and after pondering, said soberly,
Doorkeeper, what have you in mind?
I think Irian of Way may have come to us, seeking not only what she needs to know, but also what we need to know. The doorkeeper's tone was equally sober, and his smile was gone.
I think this may be a matter for talk among the nine of us.
The changer absorbed that with a look of real amazement. He did not question the doorkeeper. He said only,
But not among the students.
The doorkeeper shook his head, agreeing.
She can lodge in the town, the changer said with some relief,
while we talk behind her back.
You won't bring her into the council room, the changer said in disbelief.
The archmage brought the boy Aaron there.
But Aaron was King Labannon.
And who is Irian? The changer stood silent, and then he said quietly with respect,
My friend, what is it you think to do, to learn? What is she that you ask this for her?
Who are we, said the doorkeeper, that we refuse her without knowing what she is?